Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Today on the show, investigators say that the man shot and killed by police in Riverton on Saturday attacked the officer with a knife. But family members have doubts about whether he could have posed a physical threat.
My brother, he didn't deserve to die. His life mattered too, you know.
We follow a mom and son hunt for the first time through a new program in the Bighorn Basin.
I always say I'm very Snow White about it. It's easy to see it as just injuring, killing animals.
Sheridan is looking at possibly switching up its downtown.
It's kind of groundbreaking for the city of Sheridan and Wyodot to at least attempt something like this.
Join us for those stories and more on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. It's been nearly a week since a man was shot and killed by law enforcement outside of a Walmart store in Riverton. Last night, community members held a vigil for the man who has been identified as 58-year-old Anderson Antelope.
My brother, he didn't deserve to die. His life mattered too, you know. He was a Northern Arapaho sun dancer, you know, a long time, you know, going in, sacrificing, praying for his tribe, for his family, friends, his children, you know. Now this tragic thing happened to our family.
That's the voice of Levina Antelope, Anderson Antelope's sister. Wyoming Public Radio's tribal affairs reporter Savannah Marr has been following this story, and she joins us now. Hi, Savannah.
Hi, Bob.
So what do we know about what happened on Saturday?
Well, we know that the shooting happened sometime before 3 p.m. in front of the Walmart store in Riverton. Officials say that an officer was trying to arrest Mr. Antelope and that Antelope attacked the officer with a knife. Let's listen to a clip of County Prosecutor Pat LeBrun. He says this is what his office knows about the shooting based on eyewitness interviews.
Decedent drew an approximately 6-inch knife and stabbed the officer in the center of his chest. However, the officer's body armor stopped the knife from penetrating. The defendant continued the assault with knife in hand and was shot. He died at the scene.
The Walmart never closed, despite Antelope's body remaining on the sidewalk covered with a sheet for hours after the shooting, until at least 8 p.m. that night.
You've spoken to some witnesses who have information that's not included in those official reports. What are they telling you?
Well, they're telling me that there was a local veterans group holding a fundraiser barbecue on the sidewalk there between the two Walmart entrances. And according to witnesses, Antelope bought some food from the fundraiser, and he sort of hung around that area for a while. He may have sat down in a place where he was sort of in the way or otherwise inconveniencing shoppers. It's not clear whether the officer was there at the Walmart all along or was dispatched, but witnesses say that when the officer arrived on the scene, he spoke with Antelope for several minutes, apparently asking him to move. Eventually, witnesses say the officer tried to physically move Mr. Antelope. How that situation escalated to one where Antelope pulled a knife on the officer and the officer fired a gun, witnesses say that the officer shot Antelope in the head. We can't really be sure.
How have most people viewed this shooting in the community?
You know, reactions have been really mixed, and I have to say that it feels like Riverton is sort of divided into camps over this. There are those people who say they support the police 100% and that anyone who pulls a knife on a police officer should expect to be shot. Others point out that Antelope was older. He was 58. He was not mentally or physically healthy. And those people say that the officer should have been able to de-escalate the situation or use non-deadly force like a taser to subdue him.
You've spoken with some of Antelope's family and spent some time with members of the Northern Arapaho community. So how are they reacting to all of this?
This has really shaken Antelope's family and many parts of the Northern Arapaho community. Families say that Antelope had struggled with alcoholism for years. They say he was physically disabled because of his alcohol problem. He walked with a cane and he struggled to get around without help. I spoke last night with Antelope's nephew, Shiloh Tubals, and Tubals was housing Antelope at the time of his death. He was also his power of attorney. He told me that Antelope had a lot of health problems, including a traumatic brain injury from several years ago, and that he was prone to bouts of confusion. In this clip, he's telling me about a recent episode where Antelope didn't even recognize his own nephew.
You know, I had to actually take my time and, you know, say, hey, uncle, it's me, Shiloh. You know, are you okay? He wouldn't respond right away. So, I mean, for this officer to try to pick him up off the sidewalk, I mean, anybody would kind of freak out, you know, especially if you're confused.
Because of his poor mental and physical health, Antelope's family have some real doubts about whether he could have posed a threat to a police officer. One other thing that's been coming up is that for parts of his life, Mr. Antelope was someone that some in Riverton might derogatorily call a park ranger. That's a word that people use to describe a homeless person who sleeps in the city park in Riverton. And when someone uses that word, you sort of know implicitly that they mean a Native person. Antelope's family believes that because of that label, some in the community might have viewed him as a nuisance or as sort of a disposable person. But the family wants the community to know that his death is an enormous and very tragic loss for them.
Now, it does appear that law enforcement has said very little. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. We don't know who the officer is. We don't know what agency he or she works for, or whether he or she is still working after the shooting. We also don't know why the officer was trying to arrest Antelope. And meanwhile, rumors are flying throughout the community.
When can we expect law enforcement to release more information?
The Fremont County Coroner's Office is convening a public inquest to determine the manner and cause of Antelope's death. That means that the agencies investigating the case will present evidence to an inquest jury. In a statement Monday, though, the county coroner said his office's forensic autopsy won't be complete for possibly 4 to 5 weeks, and that we shouldn't expect any more information from that office in the meantime. Wyoming's Department of Criminal Investigation is taking the lead on investigating the shooting itself. Traditionally, the prosecutor and others will wait for the DCI report before they decide whether or not to charge the officer.
Savannah Marr is Wyoming Public Radio's tribal affairs reporter. Savannah, thank you for the update.
Thank you.
Changing gears, this seems to be impeachment week in Washington, and it's the first such event for two of Wyoming's three lawmakers in the nation's capital. And as correspondent Matt Laszlo reports from Washington, those two lawmakers are backing the president.
2 decades ago, Wyoming senior senator Mike Enzi voted to impeach Bill Clinton for obstructing justice and perjury. He's now retiring at the end of his term, and when I asked if he had anything to say about these current allegations against President Trump, he offered this.
No.
That simple no from Enzi, his not even wanting to weigh in, is worlds apart from Wyoming's other two federal lawmakers, who are both members of their respective chambers' leadership teams. After House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced the formal impeachment inquiry this week, Wyoming Congresswoman Liz Cheney was livid, especially because the partial transcript of Trump's call with the Ukrainian president hadn't even been released yet.
I think it's outrageous. I mean, I think for her to go out and hold a press conference, announce that she's launching an impeachment inquiry when she had not even seen any of the evidence is just, you know, ludicrous.
Cheney is, as you know, a Cheney, and her father have both staked out careers based on their intense neoconservative foreign policy stances. And just as it did for Dick, foreign policy matters to Liz. That's why she was also up in arms that Pelosi dropped this news while Trump was with world leaders at the UN General Assembly in New York this week.
She chose to do it the way that she did it. She chose to do it without waiting for evidence. And she chose to do it at a moment the president was up at the United Nations. I think it's a really big deal to be in a situation where the president is having bilateral meetings with other world leaders, and this thing plays out all day long, and you know he's dealing with this allegation that he's going to be impeached.
But for the majority of congressional Democrats, allegations that Trump used the stature of the United States of America to try to exact political retribution against his political opponent, Joe Biden, is even more unseemly. Virginia Democratic Congressman Jerry Connolly is on the Oversight Committee. He says Trump put lives at risk.
It's particularly egregious in the context. The context is there are Russian troops in the eastern part of the Ukraine killing Ukrainians. They need the military aid. The fact that you know that and you would do this for this narrow partisan game is unspeakably sordid and to the Republicans, is there any bottom for them at all?
House Democrats are preparing for a slew of high-profile and high-stakes hearings as they ramp up their impeachment inquiry. That will mean lots of TV cameras and the like, which isn't the tax senators are taking. Wyoming Junior Senator John Barrasso says he's glad the Senate Intelligence Committee has begun its work in closed-door sessions without cameras.
I think that the Senate Intel Committee is an appropriate place to do this in a confidential manner.
Barrasso says Democrats are just playing politics, and he says that's why they're doing so much of their investigating in front of the media.
What I really see happening is the Democrats are cranking up the outrage machine again, that they, kind of the beating the impeachment drum, the candidates running for president once again calling for impeachment.
But now that the whistleblower complaint is out, most Democrats argue voters deserve to see what Trump and his lieutenants, like Barrasso and Cheney, are trying to hide. Connecticut Democratic Senator Chris Murphy says the new information provided by a whistleblower on Trump's call with the Ukrainian president back in July shows the gravity of the case his party is trying to prove.
Yeah, I think that the complaint looks, very credible given the fact that he certainly knew exactly what was the substance of the call between Zelensky and Trump. And, I've been worried, since May.
Barrasso laughs off those charges and claims Democrats are just bitter that Trump beat Hillary Clinton back in 2016. And he says they're still upset that Special Counsel Robert Mueller didn't give them the smoking gun they've been looking for.
They didn't get what they wanted out of the Mueller investigation. They're hoping they have something here. I just don't see it.
Democrats are all in, though. Vermont Democratic Congressman Peter Welch is a member of the Intelligence Committee. He says his party is going to use the whistleblower's account to continue to pull in Trump's inner circle to prove their case.
There's a roadmap in the report by the Inspector General, reference to many people who were witness to the call, witness to the things that the president said. So there's a whole, there was no investigation that was done.
Still, Congresswoman Cheney says Democrats are chasing the wind.
The fact that they're careening, and that's the only word for it, from one theory to another theory, one target to another target, hoping something hits, and it's absolutely an abdication, and I think a betrayal of their constitutional duty, as well as national security, has real negative national security consequences for the nation.
Now that an impeachment inquiry is formal, analysts say it's not going away and will be the backdrop for the 2020 election, whether any of us or our elected officials want it or not. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
When we come back, a conversation with two former members of Congress about concerns regarding Capitol Hill and presidential powers. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. Two former members of Congress recently appeared at the University of Wyoming with former Senator Al Simpson talking about partisan politics and problems with Congress. Former Democratic U.S. Representative Brian Baird from Washington and former Republican representative from Wisconsin, Scott Klug, say the public is frustrated and most members of Congress are frustrated as well, but both differ on the fixes. We begin our conversation with Representative Baird saying how executive orders like the ones President Trump is fond of are taking away power from Congress.
What do you think about, and Obama did a lot of this, President Bush did a lot of this, Clinton obviously with the roadless rule did a lot of this. I mean, it just seems like the presidents have gained a lot of power and taken it away from Congress.
Yeah, I think they have. You know, most people don't even care or know the difference between Article 1, 2, and 3 of the Constitution. But Article 1 is the Congress, and that's purposeful. The framers did not necessarily believe in an incredibly powerful central office of the president. They believed the legislative branch should be where legislation is made. You know, you watch the debates, and everybody's talking about, this is my policy on health care, or this is my policy on taxes. Nuts to you. That has to go through the Congress. You don't get to just say this is how healthcare is going to be. And I think, unfortunately, both parties have tended to abdicate too much responsibility and given that over to the president. And we need to take a lot of it back and actually have a deliberative body that makes the laws.
Old fight, just more sharply in focus now, I think. If you go all the way back to Andrew Jackson, Congress wanted to establish a national bank, and they allocated money, and Andrew Jackson put the money in regional banks where he wanted to. So it's a long-standing fight and a strong American tradition. But I think since the advent of mass communication, television, and radio, the president's really become the central focus. It's who everybody thinks of as leading the United States. And there's this natural tension. And as Brian said, there's a lot in the Constitution about what Congress does, and there's very little about what the executive's responsibilities are. But in that vacuum, the presidents throughout the years, Republican and Democrat, have just grabbed more and more and more. But part of it also, I think it's the president acting because Congress won't act. So to get anything done, sometimes you just have to do it that way. But I'm with Brian. I mean, I think the legislature needs to be more forceful to limit the powers of the president and to actually articulate the policy, which they're not doing now.
There is some positive news, and I should have mentioned it earlier, on the congressional front. There's a bipartisan committee called the Committee for the Modernization of the Congress. It's led by a Democrat and Republican. They respect one another. They work together. They make sure that initiatives that come out of this, it's a select committee that comes out of this, have bipartisan support. And the whole goal is to try to find ways to make Congress as an institution work better for the good of the people. And that is about not only making Congress itself function, but also regaining some of the legitimate constitutional authority of Congress. So there's some positive steps being made, but those don't get the attention.
I think one of the problems is you also have so many hot button issues, and let me just throw one your guy's direction, and it's the Affordable Care Act. We all know it needs work at best. It does provide health insurance to some people, but it's certainly, I always expected there'd be a lot of amendments, some fixes to that, and it's just never happened. How do you get to this health care solution that people are craving for?
Well, and it's actually, I think, at the heart of a lot of what's going on in Washington right now. And you're torn in different directions. So Republicans have been on the repeal it, without any explanation of what follows. So sort of their worst nightmare would be if it actually got repealed, because there'd be a transition period and people would have more trouble than they have right now. On the other hand, you've got this huge fight in the Democratic caucus where most Democrats who are like Brian want to see amendments to the Affordable Care Act. And you've got the progressive wing now who wants to throw it all out, replace private insurance, and go completely to a public option. So I wish I had an easy answer for you. There isn't one, but this was a huge fight when I was in office. So I was around during we go to the State of the Union addresses, which most people watch 15 minutes of and then go on to something else. And you're in the chamber and you have to sit through it. And so I was in office for 8 years. I remember two of them, when the Iraq War ended and George Bush Sr. got a huge standing ovation. And I remember Bill Clinton standing up and saying, "This is your health insurance card. You'll have it. It's the only thing you'll ever need for health care." And I was actually on the committee that did the Hillary Clinton plan. And I remember that, how complicated that was. So, that's all the way back to 1990, 1992. It's been bubbling for years. It's a complicated issue. I think Congress is going to have to figure out a way to address it, because the expenses just keep climbing. And I think what really is out there now, if you're a hospital and you get Medicare payments, you lose money. If you're a hospital, you get Medicaid payments, you lose money, because they don't even cover the cost. And what's kept the sector alive is the public sector, the private sector, which has provided health insurance. And I think a lot of large companies now are starting to say, wait a minute, this isn't what we should be doing. And as they cut people's benefits and people have higher and higher deductibles, people thought you go to the doctor and you pay $20 for a visit. People are now getting copays of thousands of dollars because they didn't understand what their policy said. So I think as the private sector contributions to healthcare begin to diminish, then I think there's going to be a real crisis that's going to lead to an overhaul.
What do you think?
Yeah, I think Scott's right. I mean, for years the Republicans said let's start with status quo before. So 40 plus million Americans had no health insurance. Many others were just a job change away. If your kid had a pre-existing condition, your ability to get new health insurance was significantly blocked. And if you were a small business person, it was very hard to buy on the open market because you didn't have a risk pool to be part of. So all of those things existed before Obamacare. And there, like it or not, there was a need to do something. 40 million Americans not getting health insurance. Scott's right, prices were skyrocketing. So Obamacare wasn't perfect, but they cut the number of uninsured people by half, banned discrimination against pre-existing conditions, and in fact bent the curve on costs. People don't realize it, but the inflation rate of medical costs has gone down since Obamacare relative to other what it had been before. Does it need to be modified? For sure. And I agree with Scott. I think the whole push by some Democrats, though by no means all, for Medicare for all at the expense of the private insurance sector is a terrible mistake. People should have choices. We should be able to say, have a government option. If the government really can provide it more efficiently, you can choose that. But if you've got a health care plan that you like, you should be able to stay into that. The Republicans right now are making the terrible mistake of saying, we're going to get rid of Obamacare, which means taking 20 million people off health insurance with nothing to replace it. The Democrats mathematically are making a dumber mistake, which is, let's take 200 million people and tell them we're going to take their health care. But not all Democrats are doing that. And on top of that, remember, even if Senator Warren or Sanders were to become president, they can't just do this. It has to pass the Congress. And they're not going to be able to just wave a magic presidential wand and take away your health insurance.
Is there hope on the horizon?
There absolutely is hope. People still love this great constitutional democratic republic we have. Good people are serving in office. Cynicism is a way to empower dictators. And when we become cynical and we become divided, whether that's on any lines that are we're trying to divide right now, that empowers Putin, that empowers other people, and we just can't do that. We've got to find ways to reunite as a people, to set aside some of the divisions to find the common ground. And we can do that, but we're going to need to support people who are willing to do that, not just support the people who throw bombs from our side at their side.
Yeah, I think people need to stay optimistic. I mean, we've got plenty of issues and plenty of problems, but it's still the best country in the world. And the reason it works is because the American public is still in control of it. So I think it's easy to get cynical about politics. Look, I was a journalist before I was a politician, so cynicism runs pretty deep in my veins. But I think, you know, you scratch a cynic and you find a romantic. And so at the end of the day, we all have to hope the system works, because if it doesn't, it'll be a sad story for the world.
Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was former U.S. Representatives Brian Baird, a Democrat from Washington and a UW graduate, and Scott Klug, a Republican from Wisconsin. When we come back, we are going to take you hunting with some new people to the sport. This is Open Spaces. This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. In the last decade, hunting has decreased in popularity nationally. While the downward trend is not as drastic in Wyoming, the Game and Fish Department is still worried about the future. That's because hunting and fishing license fees and federal excise taxes makes up about 75% of the game and fish budget. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska reports on how a first-time hunt program could stabilize that revenue.
Don't take the shot unless I say there's your shot opportunity.
That's Fred Williams. He's in full camouflage gear whispering to Isaac Stensing. Williams is mentoring 13-year-old Isaac for his first hunt. Isaac is wearing a bright orange hat and vest. He lifts his rifle up to his face, getting ready to shoot, and waits. His mom, Katie, and I hold back until we get the thumbs up from Williams.
Isaac made a good shot, but we just need to assume that there's a follow-up shot needed, so we're going to walk up.
You did this, huh?
Yeah.
Awesome shot.
Yeah?
Yeah. Yeah. The deer died instantly.
Oh.
Isaac has a huge smile on his face, but he doesn't say much.
So how are you feeling when you shot and stuff?
I don't know. Yeah. I didn't really feel anything. I was just, you know, just focused.
Yeah, a little bit of adrenaline.
He was the assassin.
But the hunt isn't over. The gory part is about to start.
So what we're ultimately going to do is bone the deer out and take the meat off the bones, put it in a game bag, and then we'll be able to set the game bag right down in your cooler.
Later, Katie takes a turn and harvests her own deer. This is the first hunt program in the Bighorn Basin. Katie and Isaac are two of the dozen first-time hunters that will be taught and mentored and hopefully harvest their first animal like Isaac and Katie just did.
The first hunt program was a perfect storm of access to appropriate hunting opportunities and mentors that wanted to help people learn how to hunt.
That's Catherine Boswell. She is the Hunter and Angler Participation Coordinator for the Wyoming Game and Fish Department.
We're developing a program to teach people how to be mentors with the hopes that they will go home and work within their local communities to develop a mentoring program that really fits the needs of their community. In one part of Wyoming, that might be turkeys, it might be pronghorn, it might be elk, it might be deer, it might be pheasants.
Only kids aged 12 to 17 and adult women can apply. Boswell says there's a reason for this.
We are gaining many more hunters in our older age class, 65 and up, than we are gaining in our younger age classes, 12 to 17. And when we compare those numbers, we are losing about 300 hunters a year. And as those baby boomers age, we need to replace those hunters.
This is important because every hunting and angler license goes to the Wyoming Game and Fish Commission's budget. So losing hunters could mean not enough money to fund the department. And Boswell says in the last decade, the number of men that have bought a hunting license has decreased, while the number women have bought has surged.
Moms are great new hunters in that they decide what goes on the table, they decide how the weekends are spent, and they often decide the budget in a family. So when we can reach out to moms, we know that we can bring some hunters along, and more than just the mom.
Back at the private ranch, Isaac just finished field dressing and harvesting the meat of his white-tailed doe. As we are relaxing in the cool warehouse, Katie talks about growing up in Minnesota. Nobody in her immediate family hunted, but then she got married, and her in-laws were really into hunting. And after a while, her husband even picked it up.
I always say I'm very Snow White about it, just because... I don't know, just it's easy to see it as just injuring, killing animals. And obviously I wouldn't be here doing this if that's, you know, what I my same mindset. But for me, it's providing for my family.
Providing food for the table is a huge hook for new hunters. Nationally, there is a movement to eat more locally and to know where your food is coming from. Katie says that's a huge part of why she thought she should try hunting, but it's also about something else.
Super fun to do this with my son, and this is a new adventure for both of us, and so I don't know, I was super proud of him getting his first doe, and I was honored to be there to watch it and be part of it. So
yeah, that's kind of why I took my hunter safety course, so I could hunt with my dad, grandpa, and my mom.
And put food on the table, because after it's all said and done, Katie and Isaac are going home to his two younger brothers and dad with a lot of meat.
What do you want her to make?
Probably burgers.
And just like that, Katie and Isaac are two new hunters in Wyoming, and Game and Fish hopes they'll pass the tradition down. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kodalska at the Center of the West in Cody.
It's known as the Night of the Grizzlies, and it happened in Glacier National Park more than 50 years ago. As Wyoming Public Radio's Maggie Mullen reports, the repercussions of that incident are still being felt today, especially for women.
Back in the 80s, Caroline Byrd worked for the U.S. Forest Service on a seasonal trail crew just outside of Yellowstone National Park.
You know, here we were out in the wilderness for 10 days at a time.
Doing really hard labor, she says, that was super satisfying. One summer, she stayed on late into the fall. It was hunting season.
And that's when we ran across this hunter's camp where the hunter had left his, you know, he's just put his groceries inside the wall tent. He left.
Bird says the hunter had gone back into town, and while he was away, a mama bear and her cub had ransacked the camp. Bear encounters were rare at the time. That's why a special agent came all the way from Colorado to investigate.
He was aghast that women were working in the backcountry where there were bears. And we were like, no, that's not the issue. The issue is this hunter left his food and bears got into it.
That's when the Forest Service told Bird and three other women on her crew that they would no longer be able to work in bear country. And here's the kicker, while they were on their periods.
Why are we getting restricted like this when this has nothing to do with the fact that there are women on a timber crew working in bear country?
The women were outraged. So they wrote to the Federal Equal Employment Opportunity Office in Denver, and the policy was rescinded shortly afterwards. But where exactly did the idea that menstruating women are at a greater risk in bear country come from? That goes back to one fateful night in 1967, the night of the grizzlies.
There was the two attacks in Glacier National Park where two different women were killed by two different grizzly bears on the same night.
That's Kerry Gunther. He's a bear biologist for Yellowstone National Park. He says the attacks caused the National Park Service to start enforcing regulations for how campers stored food or anything else with an odor.
But it also sparked speculation. Having two fatalities in one night was just so rare that people were groping for a reason. And one theory that came about was menstruation might have led to these two fatal bear attacks in Glacier.
Only one of the women killed was on her period, but the theory stuck. That's why decades later, Caroline Bird and her female colleagues were told they couldn't work in bear country while they were menstruating. And why, in 1988, as a graduate student in environmental studies, Bird tried to debunk the myth.
I ran a whole statistical analysis of, is there anything out there that shows that bears react differently to women than to men? And, you know, it came out really strong that no, bears do not respond or react or in any way change their behavior based on the gender of the person that they're encountering.
This lack of definitive evidence remains true today, but so does the myth. Versions of it are easy to find. Just ask some women on the University of Wyoming's campus.
I've heard that with swimming in the ocean, with sharks and stuff.
No, I mean, I've heard it before, but I think as a joke.
Oh, I actually have heard this.
And it's possible Yellowstone's website may not be helping. It does have a whole page dedicated to menstruating women in bear country that cites Bird's statistical analysis, but it also says women can take precautions if they're concerned, like using tampons instead of pads. Margaret Seeley is a reporter that has written about the bears and periods myth.
I do feel like the way it's worded on the website right now is problematic.
The website also references a study from the late 70s that tested how polar bears would react to menstrual blood in different scenarios, like how a caged polar bear reacted to a used tampon versus other odors. But both Bird and Seeley say the research methods were flawed, and Seeley says including the study on the website perpetuates the misconception.
It's continuing to support and promote the myth that polar bears or bears are attracted or affected by menstruating women, which again is different than a blood-soaked tampon.
Seeley is an avid hiker. Before her own reporting, she was pretty sure that being out in bear country while menstruating was dangerous. And she says fears like this keep women out of the woods, and that becomes an issue of quality of life.
I don't belong in this air-conditioned office. I belong out in the world, and I belong in nature.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Maggie Mullen.
Sagebrush is not growing well in Wyoming. It's been decades of using the same method to try and regrow the keystone species, with minimal success. Experts are now trying a new strategy, and it's one that also benefits Wyoming's prisons. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim explains.
All right, we'll have someone out in just a moment.
Driving down a long rural road in central Wyoming, Gina Klingerman pulls up to the gate of a minimum security prison called the Honor Farm. A security guard gives the truck a once-over.
Tobacco, lighters, everything like that stays inside the vehicle. You don't have any guns, knives, bazookas, anything like that.
Once inside, the prison opens up like a college campus. Green grass, picturesque trees, and colonial-looking buildings. No barbed wire or anything in sight. Inmates walk the grounds freely, all wearing the same getup. Jeans and a collared shirt, either red or orange. Klingerman is an archaeologist with the Bureau of Land Management, or BLM. She's here to check on a program she helped implement, the Sagebrush in Prisons Project. Inmates here are growing sagebrush in a greenhouse that will then be planted to reclaim abandoned mine land in the state. This project is done in 7 other states, though Wyoming is the latest. The goal? To improve how the prickly green bush grows on disturbed lands. It's well known that the sagebrush landscape has been fragmented by wildfires and development. But another part was surprising. It's not easy to grow back.
On average, a sagebrush will have thousands of seeds, and only 5% of those seeds, when dropped to the ground, will grow.
Yet scattering seeds is what Wyoming has done unsuccessfully for decades for reclamation. Klingerman says sagebrush is critical to hundreds of species, providing nutrients, shade, habitat.
It's a keystone species in this whole vast ecosystem that without it, everything else suffers.
Several years ago, Wyoming's BLM, along with several state agencies, thought about a different way to grow sagebrush.
I don't know what the story is.
A way that improves the success rate of growth from 5% to 90.
Now we're at the point where we're trimming. We water them twice a day, but where we're at now is getting them down.
That's Chris Eagleroad from Cheyenne, one of the inmates helping employ this new strategy. Instead of scattering seeds, he's helping grow the sagebrush to a tougher seedling that will have a far better chance of surviving the Wild West. He's in a greenhouse with 2 other inmates. In the background, a few are cutting concrete. Some others are planting flowers along the road. Eagleroad, Michael Catt, and Drew Moore all applied and were interviewed to be a part of this earlier this year. Behind them, 3 rows of long tables hold hundreds of little sagebrush plants. Moore says they've already grown a lot.
We were worried to begin with that it wasn't going to grow nothing. But now you come and see it every day, it's like, yeah, it's really nice to see them growing good and trimming them out. And
yeah.
Eagleroad says they feel pride in watching them grow. Here's the 3rd inmate, Michael Catt.
In a sense of maternal pride, I guess, watching these grow. We're very protective of our plants.
He even plays guitar to them. The inmates aren't just growing the plants, but studying and learning about the value of sagebrush west-wide. Eagleroad says that's been impactful.
Just I didn't realize how much, especially in this state, that it's been affected and how much the habitat that it actually does sustain. So. And how much has been destroyed here just from, you know, because I've worked in the oil field industry, so that industry alone has, you know, decimated it.
To Drew Moore, it's great to be able to work with the plants, but also personally, it's been satisfying just to be in a greenhouse with these guys.
We're at lows in our life, and now that we all work together and we're giving back, we come in here and talk about things like jobs that we have in mind, and, you know, we talk about our feelings and the camaraderie.
They talk about the possibility of a job after prison and the reclamation of old energy sites or wildfire-ravaged land. Catt says he'll put it on his resume and imagines his upcoming parole board hearing. And when they do leave, they'll have left something behind.
So I know when I leave here, I'm going back to Montana. I've left my footprint here. I've done my part.
In November, the 3 guys expect to leave the confines of the Honor Farm and actually plant these seedlings at several abandoned uranium mine sites in central Wyoming. Executive assistant at the Honor Farm, Cindy Ferguson, listens in on this whole conversation.
Some of them have just been put me in tears. I mean, it's phenomenal, just phenomenal.
She's been at the Honor Farm for about 15 years and watched how helpful programs like this can be. Ferguson says they can help prepare inmates for the real world.
But I think the ultimate goal is still the same, and it's to prepare you and to help you get back into being a viable contribution to society. They might be your neighbor one day, and so how do you want to treat them?
This program isn't even done with its first year, but the hope is that it'll help sagebrush reverse habitat fragmentation and stabilize reliant species like sage grouse, all while giving a unique opportunity at the human level, too. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cooper McKim.
When we come back, we will learn about a possible change to Sheridan's main drag. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. A New York City ballet company is coming to Cheyenne. Their show is called Cocktail Hour. It's exactly what it sounds like, dance vignettes of drinks. The Bloody Mary, the Mint Julep, the Shirley Temple, all performed with original choreography, music, and costumes. This is classical ballet with a twist. Wyoming Public Radio's Aaron Jones spoke with the choreographer, Marilyn Claus.
Cocktail Hour is a show that has been created to really get American audiences out of their living rooms and into the theater again. The dance audiences have sort of fallen off in the United States. So this is an entertaining concept. It is a classical concept. All of the dancers are classically trained, but we try to give the audience a nightlife experience as if they were attending a New York nightclub, be it from the 30s, maybe when Ricky Ricardo and Lucille Ball were entertaining audiences, or in the disco era, or a vaudeville or a French theater.
I guess I hadn't thought about that before, that type of entertainment, like the Lucille Ball entertainment and the nightclub entertainment of dancing, has kind of fallen off. Do you know why that is?
A lot of the dance that's in universities and in the cities nowadays isn't very performance oriented. It's more about the personal expression of the entertainer. And I shouldn't even say entertainer, the personal experience of the practitioner, of the person who is moving. And I'm really using the form of the ballet because I feel that it's an extreme form. It's something that people are amazed by when they see an excellent, beautifully trained ballet dancer. And it's a kind of form that's eternally modern because it's based on the scientific principles of the human physique.
So why do you think it's important to come back to the more performance aspect or connection with audience aspect of dance?
Because I think the audience actually gets something from it. It's not personal. It's we're creating artwork for the audience to get something from, as opposed to that the performer alone gets something from.
Cocktail Hour is a series of vignettes that are dancing drinks, or I guess
yes.
Like they're dancing a story of a drink. And how do you go about choreographing a drink?
Yeah, I think cocktails are something that people worldwide associate with a certain magic. So when they go into a bar or a lounge, you know, be it the fanciest place like maybe the Ritz in Paris or just like a roadside bar, they're going there because they want to relax. They have a sense of what they want to order. For instance, one of the dances that we're doing in Cheyenne is Mint Julep. And as Americans, we associate that with the Kentucky Derby. So we have really tall thoroughbreds. And those are the really tall ballerinas who, when they have on their pointe shoes, are about 5 or 6 inches in normal height. And so they can really be regal and impressive. We have the racetrack owner's daughter. And then we have the trainers and the jockeys. And then in Cheyenne, we're going to have the local ponies because we're auditioning and working with young ballet dancers in Cheyenne and putting them on the stage. The Mint Julep took maybe about 10 months to create, and it's only about an 8-minute piece. The composer used live banjo and a lot of music that you might hear from Kentucky, even though it's a composition that he worked on classically. And then, of course, the costume designer, Catherine Zaire, she came a lot to rehearsal. She figured out, how can I give the audience a feel for who these characters are. So that's just one piece and that we're very excited to do in Cheyenne.
Marilyn, do you have a favorite choreographed cocktail?
I adore Zombie. The Zombie, to me, how I created it was like a sci-fi pool splash, like an LA kind of feeling or a Hollywood feeling that the zombies come and take your character and your personality. And the women also wear giant pearls as if they were in the 60s or the kind of pearls that Barbara Bush used to wear. And then they have these red lace visors that they wear over their eyes that make them look like they have bloodshot eyes. I really, really love it. And it's funny, the dancers were saying last night how much they loved the music. We brought it back into circulation to do in Cheyenne because it's since we're performing in October.
And do you have a favorite cocktail to drink?
Yes, I used to love the margarita. I do not drink anymore. But the margarita I love, and I love our margarita dance that we do because she's a goddess. She's a Mayan goddess and sort of combined with the Virgin Mary. So it's a spiritual, thing, but it's also a pun, right? Having to do with, spirits and all of that. I do love the margarita. And I know that the agave plant, which is what tequila is made from, is pollinated by bats, which really kind of sends me.
That's choreographer Marilyn Claus speaking with Wyoming Public Radio's Aaron Jones. The ballet show will be served up with drinks, and it's family-friendly. You can see Cocktail Hour at the Cheyenne Civic Center on the evening of Friday, October 4th. One of Sheridan's biggest pride and joys is its main street. For years, it's become known for drawing in tourists and residents alike. Now the city is considering making a big change to see if it can improve its award-winning downtown. Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler has more.
Sheridan's Main Street is the heart of the city. There's a historic theater, shops, and restaurants that really show off its Western heritage. It's the place where the community gathers for festivals and events. And now, it might be changing. Since mid-August, Sheridan has been testing the idea of reconfiguring its Main Street. The redesign changed the number of lanes on Main Street from 4 lanes to 2 with a center turn lane. And it also added a 4-foot buffer zone between parked cars and traffic lanes. Brian Craig is Sheridan's Community Development Director. He says community leaders started talking last year about ways to transform Main Street and make downtown a place residents and visitors want to spend more time.
That's the main overarching theme is placemaking, community building, making sure that we had a place that not only visitors like to come and hang out, but also our community can really get behind and be proud of.
For the past year or so, Sheridan and the Wyoming Department of Transportation joined forces to make the experiment a reality. And it's been exciting for both parties to work on the plans. YDOT District Engineer Scott Taylor says this is the first time a reconfiguration test like this has been performed on a state highway.
It's pretty cool because it's kind of groundbreaking for the city of Sheridan and YDOT to at least attempt something like this.
After several weeks of living with the new configuration, the city and YDOT revealed the results of their surveys and data from the test at a public meeting. District Traffic Engineer Michelle Edwards says the change didn't cause many drivers to avoid Main Street, though they did feel some impact.
It really appeared to function pretty adequately during our peak periods, but we did see queues back up into the intersections every once in a while, usually related to someone making a parallel parking maneuver close to an intersection.
Edwards says a few other issues came up too. The new buffer zone was striped to kind of look like a bike lane, which led to a lot of confusion. She says if the idea goes through, they'll look at different ways to stripe it, and they'll figure out a better way to merge cars on the north end of Main. Beyond traffic impacts, the city also wanted to gauge how residents felt about the changes. Brian Craig with the city says the results are mostly positive.
We got great results, close to 1,000 responses, close to 2/3 positive. And of the remaining, it was 7 or 8% neutral. So Only a little less than 30% were negative or didn't want to see the test continue permanently.
Craig says most of the positive responses say it's safer to be downtown, whether that's walking or parking. Some business owners say their customers are mostly in favor of it and that it's safer for kids or people with disabilities to get in and out of parked cars and get into their shops. PJ Tridy owns Bighorn Design Studio on Main Street. He says he's in favor of the change.
Watching people now come downtown, the traffic is a little bit slower, but we seem to think that that's actually a better thing. People are looking around, seeing the businesses.
There are also concerns about the slower pace and that traffic backs up when someone is taking too long to parallel park. Now, the city and YDOT have to think about whether a permanent change is the right solution. And if it is, the big question is when to do it. YDOT is planning to resurface Main Street in 2023, and Craig says that plays into what could happen next.
The three options are do it as soon as possible when the numbers and the ability and the material arrives, do it in 2023, or leave it as the four lane.
If the city decided to change the road before the resurfacing, it could cost anywhere between $50,000 to more than $200,000. But if the city waits, YDOT says it could likely pick up some of the tab, and the city could also try to qualify for grant money. YDOT says they need a decision from the community by March 1st. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Catherine Wheeler in Sheridan.
We hope you enjoyed Open Spaces. You can find the entire show and individual segments on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Or our individual stories can also be found via our Facebook page. And never miss an episode by getting our podcast through our website or wherever you get your podcasts. Anna Rader is our web editor. Please support Open Spaces in all of our Wyoming news coverage with your pledge of support. You can either call us or go online at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.